Hello, this is Dan Le Batard. Welcome to another edition of South Beach Sessions. If you've been listening for a while, you know that there are a number of different writers that I admire, journalists that I admire, and David Simon, obviously very high on that list, is someone who not only created The Wire, but basically foretold anyone who wasn't paying attention what it is that we're presently witnessing in America during that show. It is viewed as one of the best television shows of all time, at least in part because it showed a lot of people a gritty underbelly and regarding the war on drugs that many of us hadn't seen. And so in this time in America, I just sort of wanted to talk to David Simon, not just about The Wire, but just everything that's happening in this country, as we like to talk to people who are really smart about things inside and outside of sports. Before we get to this conversation, though, here's Mike Ryan to tell you a little bit about who it is that's keeping South Beach Sessions free content for you. Support the sponsors who support us. Mike, tell the people who's supporting us this week. So if you've been listening to our radio show for a long time, you know how much I admire this man. Now, a lot of you associate him with what is considered the best television show of all time by a lot of people, The Wire, HBO. He has moved past that creatively in a lot of ways, but he basically foretold what it is that's happening in America right now on his television show. And I'm going to give you a direct quote from him before we get started, so you can see how his television show basically told you that this was coming. This is what David Simon says of The Wire. The Wire is a show about how contemporary American society, and particularly raw, unencumbered capitalism, devalues human beings. Every single moment on the planet, from here on out, human beings are worth less. We are in a post-industrial age. We don't need as many of us as we once did. So if the first season was about devaluing the cops who knew their beats and their corner boys slinging drugs, then the second was about devaluing the longshoremen and their labor. The third about people who wanted to make changes in the city. And the fourth was about kids who were being prepared badly for an economy that no longer really needs them. And the fifth, it's about the people who are supposed to be monitoring all this and sounding the alarm. The journalists. The newsroom I worked in had 450 people. Now it's got 300. Management says we have to do more with less. That's the bullshit of bean counters who care only about the bottom line. You do less with less. So David Simon is on with us now. Did you know when you were making The Wire, did you know that that this was coming? Like somehow that we were going to end up in a post-apocalyptic place because of race wars, because of climate change, because of journalism dying?
There's a few things I did not see coming. I don't think I saw somebody as abysmal a human being as our current president achieving that high office. I don't think I understood, certainly not as far back as 2008, what was going to replace the vacuum that had been mainstream media and the basic, even centrist arguments of responsible journalism. I didn't anticipate social media and a culture in which the lie, the grandiose lie, would travel as far as, and as fast as it does. So I did not see the collapse of our normative political culture happening this quickly. That I had no clue. Had to see that happen to believe it. And probably the other thing I didn't see when it comes to policing and the culture of race as it affects, and racism as it affects policing. I think in 2008, I wasn't yet fully aware of what the revolution of the smartphone was going to mean in terms of exposing the brutalities of policing. If you covered it in the pre-digital age, you knew that basically there was a certain tyranny to being a patrolman in America, that it was your word against anybody on the street. And if the person on the street had even some remote criminal history, your say-so about what happened was going to prevail. As long as you could write your way out of trouble, you could pretty much do a lot of damage and a lot of hostile things. The idea that everybody would be carrying a phone with them that could create video, first-generation evidence of how things happened on the street, that's been a revolution, and that postdates The Wire, and that's fascinating. As far as what the drug war was and what mass incarceration was and the disregard for human beings now that we don't need as many people in as many factories, I think we got that right. There's been stuff that has been surprising.
How did you know? Was it working in the Baltimore streets? Was it the, street journalism that you were doing and watching the police beats? How did you know that The Wire would make for a great project that would be this kind of layered and that would make the impact. Well, you couldn't have imagined it would make this kind of impact. You couldn't have had any idea, even if you're in love with your genius.
Listen, I don't even know what kind of impact are we talking about. The Wire, if it had one critique that it kept making over and over again to the point of being an irritant, it was probably this. It was end the drug war. Stop policing drugs. Start policing that which matters. Stop over-policing poor people. Stop over-policing communities of color on this manufactured prohibition that is basically pretending to be a war on drugs, but is effectively a war on the poor. Stop this. Cease doing this. Devote the resources to actually solving robberies and rapes and murders and the things that make the city untenable for everybody. Do the hard work of police work. That was like the fundamental argument of the show. And the drug war still keeps going. And mass incarceration, we're still struggling with it. I mean, there have been some feints at trying to transform law enforcement, but basically there's too much invested. There's too much money in brutalizing people and in jailing people. You want to talk about impact? I would say that the one argument that The Wire made probably more effectively than anything has been largely ignored.
Okay, so what you're saying there is that it's a popular work that people cite as the greatest television show of all time, but you don't think it's actually moved mountains. You think that you've been shouting about this stuff for many, many years, and look at where we are.
Well, and now I find myself yelling at and being yelled at by people on both sides of the equation, which is to say, rather than get us to a point where we address the actual hard part of self-governance, of where we start to look at the mission creep that has transformed police into being an army of occupation in our cities, and a hated army of occupation at that, rather than look at the mission of what we're asking police to do and change that, which is hard work, that's us governing ourselves, I find myself shaking my head in both directions at the people who want to continue to use the police as an oppressive entity and continue to over-police Americans. They're useless. And now the vernacular of abolish the police is just as surreal. I live in a city with 330 murders, 340 murders a year. It used to be a city with 200 murders a year. The difference is not all the structural racism, because that has been a standard. You know, it's by the way, it was certainly a standard in 1980 or 1960 or 1990. It hasn't gone away, but it is a constant. And if you eliminate the constant, the real change in my city has been that, you know, the police now can only lock up or clear 30% of the murders. You know, when I was in the homicide unit in the late 80s, early 90s, it was 70%. So if you're going to say that actually having police doesn't matter, that the police are useless to our problems, you're not helping on the other end. Because the truth is, police have one job, which is to lock up the right guy for the right crime. And they're no longer doing that. And that has been transformational. So now I live in a city that has the worst crime rate in its history, its recorded history. So, you know, I look at where the political dialogue has gone, and it's this, you know, this sort of tragic binary. Nobody's capable of standing over the guts of the problem and addressing the problem, saying, do this, stop doing this, do this. Because that's basically a society trying to govern itself and use its resources.
Help me, though, because I believe you are a nuanced, reasonable voice on all of this. I believe that you care about people. I believe that your art demonstrates that you are someone who is filled with rage at this point by what it is that he's seeing, but that your art says to everybody, look at these problems, I want to fix them. What is David Simon saying? Like, this is how we fix this. Stop being distracted by bullshit. Here's how we fix this.
End the drug war. End the drug war right now. And you don't need Congress to do it. You know, this can be done locally. It can be done by mayors. It can be done by governors. It can be done by county executives. It can be done by state's attorneys and district attorneys. You know, the way you end the drug war in Baltimore is if you're the state's attorney and you're the mayor, you say, look, we're not paying overtime, we're not paying court pay if you lock somebody up for drugs. We're not doing that. Go out, learn your post, learn the people on your post, understand what's happening on your post, and when the detectives come around with a shooting or a robbery and they're doing retroactive investigation, take it to the point where we actually arrest the right guy. That's going to make the city safer. It's also going to demonstrate to these communities that their lives are fundamentally as valuable and as essential as in more affluent places or in whiter places. Our failure to do that has basically led to an alienation that's profound, because the police in my city, they sweep the corners, they take bodies, they fill the jails, they fill the wagons, and they accomplish nothing. And yet when somebody shoots someone else, that guy goes right back up to the corner. He's never caught. And what that says to, you know, in West Baltimore, East Baltimore, or Pimlico, or Cherry Hill, what that says in my city is your lives just aren't, they don't matter to us. We can't make money off them. Whereas if we just keep making drug arrests that mean nothing, that achieve nothing, then we're doing fine. And the cynicism of that, and the fact that certain people buy into the idea that the city can thrive without basically the fundamental of law enforcement, is incredibly naive. So it's like even from the people who are ostensibly my allies in terms of the people I need to be screaming for reform, real reform, they're not exactly sure what their imagined reform is. You know, it's as disappointing as it is the intransigence of the status quo. But that's who we are.
I get off of your Twitter feed, I get these bursts of rage and frustration and what feels like helplessness and hopelessness. Is it
hopefully
because
you get some profanity too?
Yeah, and that too. But it's because I feel like you're standing over the guts of the problem and you're like, will you fucking people listen? Will you look in the right places? Like, what are you doing? What are we wasting our time with? It just feels like you've been yelling about this for a long time, David.
Well, it's not just me. You know, I keep recommending a book to people. That Jill Levy wrote a book called Ghetto Side about, she followed the crime in South Central, in Los Angeles. And she came up with the same fundamental that I did in Baltimore, which is, it's a complicated answer. It's counterintuitive. Everyone wants to say, if the police would just leave poor people alone, if they would leave people of color alone, if they would stop being, you know, oppressive and brutalizing, we could solve this problem. Let's give all the money to social work, or let's, you know, improve the schools. By the way, the idea of holding the police to account for the ridiculous levels of funding necessary to have a drug prohibition or to do mass incarceration, I totally agree with that. The idea of budget accountability is great. But the idea of, you know, yes, there has to be some accountability, but that's not the same thing as saying, yes, you're over-policing, but you're also under-policing. When somebody shoots someone else and they stay on the corner, and because the drug culture is such as it is, and in places like West Baltimore, the factories are gone, and the drug corner is hiring, and it is a fundamental economic reality. And so the idea that you have a culture of enforcement and violence on that corner, it's the effect of basically serial killing without the psychosexual component. It's a guy who will have a gun, and he'll shoot somebody. If the police don't come and get him in 2 months or 2 weeks, he's going to shoot somebody else. And if they don't come and get him again, in another 2 months, he's going to shoot two more people. Because he's in a game in which violence is its own argument. And ultimately, if society has no response to that, that's the difference between a city of 600,000 that has 200 murders a year, which is bad enough, and a city that has 340 a year. Because on some level, although it's not charming and it doesn't lend itself to a lofty slogan, part of governing ourselves is we have to mow the lawn. And when people kill people, there has to be a meaningful response by society. Right now, the police are incapable of that. They actually can't do the job they're supposed to do. And we've trained them to do the job that, my God, it's all it's doing is brutalizing people.
Do you somehow believe, or are you so hard on yourself that you view The Wire as an underachievement because it didn't result in reform?
No. I mean, how do I explain this? Years ago when I was a newspaper reporter, when I was just starting out, I don't know if I told you this story before, but the thing that got me hired at the Baltimore Sun when I was 22 years old, right out of college, was I caught this basketball coach at the University of Maryland in a scandal. It was what would today be called an outrageous Me Too scandal. And he should have been fired. In fact, not to use his name, but they just put him in ACC Hall of Fame. I found that fascinating because what he was involved with in 1983 was an astonishing moment of misogyny. And it got me hired at the Sun. You know, obviously, I got down on my hands and knees before bed for a year after that, thanking him for being, you know, who he was, because he got me a job. But something happened then, which is that I called him dead to rights. I mean, you know, there was a university administrator on the other end of the phone listening to him scream at a co-ed that he would ruin her reputation. And so he was caught. Like, I mean, you know, the story caught him. And I watched the university do a pretend investigation for about 9 months. And then they slapped his wrist and gave him a 5-year contract for more money than God. And I'm telling you, at that moment, I said something to myself that is, it's kept me sane, which is, I'm responsible for the story. I'm responsible for getting the story correct. I'm responsible for telling the story as best I can. And what happens after that is not my pay grade. I get us to the point of saying, well, you can't say you didn't know. That I can be responsible for. But if you're asking me if I write stories and think, well, this will change the world for the better, I lost that vanity as far back as 1983.
Can you entertain one more question about The Wire? Is Stringer Bell the tragic hero of the story to the writers?
In my head, I think the only hero in that piece is Bubbles, to be honest with you. That's the only heroic journey I saw delivered consistently. I think Stringer had some clarity about certain things, about the reality of certain things, and about the hypocrisies inherent in drug prohibition. In a perfect world, he might have conceivably reformed certain excesses, but it's not a perfect world, and he was not a perfect architect of anything. And yeah, I don't know about hero, but you know, he had a little more clarity about certain things. It's probably fair to say.
Is there anything else that you think in The Wire that people missed, a theme that they missed? Like, for example, that everything that you're talking about in terms of factors, those things were crushing black people and white people.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about what's wrong with television, how many television police procedurals there are, and how that has fed into a thin blue line paradigm of institutional heroism. And that has, of course, fed the drug war and the militarization, increased militarization of police. And I think, by and large, judging by the commentary that I've read, I think most people understood that The Wire was actually taking a flamethrower to that. But there are some people who, I think, misapprehend the idea that just because we're at pains to make everybody human and flawed, meaning when we wrote a drug dealer, we wrote him as human and flawed. When we wrote a cop, we wrote him as human and flawed. We cared about every character. We wanted the characters to be credible on the page and in our minds. But that's not, you know, making somebody human does not obviate the critique of the drug war or of mass incarceration or of the militarization of police. Those scenes are all there. You know, if you watch The Wire, that's your critique. Those scenes are all there. That criticism stands. But there are some people now who can't bear. They're so angry at police, you know, with some degree of understanding that they're angry at police. I mean, this astonishing array of brutality that's come to light because of the smartphone revolution. They're at the point now where they can't bear to have any police characters rendered as human, even if they're fighting the wrong war, even if they're brutal at points. You know, I mean, I understand that, but I'm pretty comfortable with what we made, I have to say. I think it stands precisely in terms of this moment politically.
But it would have been totally different if John C. Reilly had been Jimmy McNulty like you want it. Like, for as much of a genius as you are, and John C. Reilly is his own kind of genius, but it's a totally different show. It doesn't get to be one of the best shows ever if John C. Reilly is Jimmy McNulty.
I don't know. Listen, I loved what Dominic West did with that role. I loved it, and I loved working with him. And once he took it, it's hard to imagine anything else. But John C. Reilly, he would have been a different McNulty, but he would have been McNulty. He'd have occupied the same space. His vices would have been his vices. It just would have been played differently. There was a funny story that when the two of those guys were on the movie Chicago and they had scenes together and they were working together, and you know, John C. Reilly did not take the role and Dominic did, and they looked at each other. They're so very different. They're like, "What are those? Did those guys have a plan? Because you know, they wanted you and me. You know, it made no sense for them standing there in the room with each other."
You have been working now for, what is it, 4 years? Is it 3 years on The Plot Against America? And you've poured your soul into this miniseries, it sounds like. What has been happening that led you to that path?
Well, a demagogue, trading in our fear of the other, our fear of immigrants, and our fear of outsiders, a xenophobic demagogue who's metastasizing the worst elements of American life, became our national leader. And that's the same thing that happened to a surprising extent in Philip Roth's novel, which, of course, was published without anticipating Donald Trump in any way. But as Roth conceded, I got a chance to talk to him about it before we started work on the project, as he conceded, you know, by whatever circumstance, the rise of Donald Trump in America was analogous to what he imagined with the rise of Lindbergh in 1940 in his ultimate history. In fact, I would say he would have told you it was more analogous than what people were claiming for the novel when it was published, which was that people thought it was a metaphor for George W. Bush and the misadventure in Iraq. And Roth would have said no. You know, he wasn't aiming for that, but somehow he hit Donald Trump a decade later, more than a decade later. So once I observed 2016, as a lot of us did, that novel just stuck out, just started screaming at us that it needed to get made.
Did you have any idea that, and because I've been talking about race on our show for a long time, and what's become clear to me is how badly I was underestimating the problem, because I was badly underestimating it. Did you have any idea that there was this much oppressed white rage that could be run on as a platform?
I did not. I had to say, I thought in certain quarters, I mean, I saw the reaction to Obama. I saw what the Tea Party was. I saw the overreaction to there being a person of color as the president. But I did feel as if it was much less of a plurality in the country than it clearly is. That has been an education. If you'd have said to me that 10 or 15% of the country is irredeemable when it comes to race, I'd have agreed with you. The idea that 10 or 15% is completely irredeemable, but there's another 15% that are almost fellow travelers when it comes to tolerating or rationalizing this level of xenophobia and fear-mongering and race hate, I wouldn't have believed it until I saw it put into political effect.
What alarms you the most? Your rage is sort of fueled by everything that's happening right now.
I'm scared because information systems are unreliable. There's two things that upon which the future of the republic, of self-governance, of the idea of we the people, rest. Without these two things, we will fail. We're going to fail as this, as the American experiment in self-governance is going to fail. The two things that were always presumed from jump are that the electorate will be moderately educated by a fundamental reality. And the second thing is that the votes, by and large, once cast, will actually be the votes. And short of those two things, I don't see how anything works. Well, right now, because of the decline in the mainstream media, and by the way, you read a quote about I was bemoaning the fact that my newspaper had gone from 450 people down to 300. That newspaper now has about 90 people in the region, covering the same metro region, which only has more profound problems. So the idea that mainstream media was going to cede the floor to a social media construct that can lie with as much effectiveness and with greater speed than anyone trying to tell a complicated truth. Simple lies travel so much faster and with such greater efficacy. The idea that we were going to replace reality and the idea that voters were going to go into a voting booth with some fundamental construct of what reality is and what's actually happening with basically agitprop, that's terrifying to me. It's just terrifying that this stuff is vanquished. Everyone used to complain because the mainstream media was the doorkeeper, and every voice was heard, and dissent was hard because it was such a centrist construct. And a lot of that's true. You know, there are moments of dissent that were denied access because of mainstream media. But the one thing mainstream media did have was it had some vetting process by which the most astonishing lies and the most ridiculous premises were defeated very early. You know, I mean, I can tell you that I was very proud in journalism of any number of moments where I stood around with other editors or writers arguing or having it argued to me sometimes that we didn't have the story, that what we thought was true was not yet proven, and that we either had to do more reporting or we had to spike the story. Some of the best and most honest moments of journalism in my life were about not putting something in the paper because we didn't have it or because what we thought we had really wasn't the case. There's no such thing with the internet anymore. There's no such thing with social media. The moment somebody dreams it as something they want to be true, it goes around the world. And the idea that we're going to run a democracy with that feeding us as the elemental information by which we act. That's dangerous as hell. And the second thing is the idea that when you go in, you press a lever and you think you're voting for one guy, but the vote doesn't count, or you're not allowed into the booth, or it, you know, the machine malfunctions, or there's no record of who you actually voted for. The idea that we've ceded the basic fundamentals of accountability in our electoral process, that's the second thing that scares the hell out of me.
It's not a big leap from there, though, to freedom collapsing, right? Like, that's when you talk about being terrified, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah. I am terrified that the Republic is on its last legs. That sounds hyperbolic, I know. But the trick to being frightened is not to be frightened in 1939. The trick to being, you know, once it's 1941, it's too late to be frightened. It's too late to be wary. You want to do it before the Night of the Long Knives. You want to do it before the Reichstag burns. You know, there are moments where history is still reversible, and where standing up and dissenting from something that is clearly anti-democratic has efficacy. And there's moments where it's just pyrrhic, where it's, oh, okay, well, now that I've strung the barbed wire, I guess we can officially say that something went wrong. It's too late then. You got to jump when you got to jump. And I'm afraid that it's kind of like the frog boiling in water.
The time is now, no? I mean, the plot against America, you're making work now that you are saying there's still time for dissent. You have not given up hope.
Even if I did give up hope, what's the choice? There's a couple of good quotes that I always use. I'll go past the one I usually use by Camus, and I'll use the one by I.F. Stone, the journalist, who said, sometimes the fights that you have to have and the ones that are worth having are the ones you know you're going to lose. And what he meant by that, and he explained it, was you may lose the fight, but having the fight, vocalizing it, speaking to what has to happen, it makes it easier for the next guy to stand up, and the next guy, and the next guy, and eventually enough people stand up so that you win. And maybe you don't. Maybe enough people don't stand up. Maybe you lose. But either way, you know, to go back to the Camus quote, you know, either way, to not stand up offers no dignity. You know, both, you might lose either way, but only one side offers dignity. So stand up, because dignity matters.
You speak of newspapers in a reverential tone. Is there any hope that you can see that the big billionaires are still investing in what, you know, few newspapers could still stand up?
I mean, they're not. The national newspapers are doing fine. The New York Times and the Washington Post have managed to achieve a revenue stream based on electronic subscription models that will allow them to continue to do what they do. And it's imperfect. They are leeching out some revenue. They have their own issues as far as content. That's not the part of journalism that's threatened. What's threatened in journalism is the state and local coverage that came from the second tier of newspapers around the country, those that do not have a national presence, those that cannot command national subscription bases. They let the horse out of the barn door when they gave away their content for free. And, of course, when they started giving away their content for free on the Internet, they had 350, 400 reporters and editors in a place like the Baltimore Sun. So they had a level of content that was X, and now they have X minus 60%, 70%. Now they're in no position to command a paid subscription model. They've leached out so much talent and so much coverage that they're shells. And those are the places where, you know, as has been famously said by a lot of people, now's the time where you want to be a corrupt state or local politician in America, because you know, nobody's covering the zoning board the way they once did. Nobody's covering the courthouse. You know, nobody's covering City Hall in the same fundamental way that they did.
It's crazy to me.
People are.
It's crazy to me, though, David, that either young people or who do I blame here for not understanding the value of that and not understanding what a threat to democracy it is to not have that anymore, to sort of shrug your shoulders about that particular checks and balances is heartbreaking.
There's a lot of people to blame. You can send it around, but let's start with the newspaper executives that listened to Wall Street 20 and 30 years ago when Wall Street explained to them that they could have more profitable entities by putting out weaker products with less, you know, with a smaller news hole and less staff. They could make more money with shittier newspapers, because that's exactly what the 1980s and 1990s were about. They were about taking the profit margins in newspapers from 13, 14, 15% up to 28, 29, 30% by putting out lesser products, I took a buyout in 1995. The internet was just a whisper. The internet had the leeching of the revenue stream by the internet had not begun, and I was the third buyout at the Baltimore paper. They were doing it for profit, and not because they were effectively journalists, but because they were beholden to the great newspaper chains of America were beholden to a Wall Street model that said the quarterly profit report is that's the metric for whether you're a good newspaper or a bad newspaper. And those guys who effectively, you know, led the disaster, they're all on the golf course. If they're still alive, they're on the golf course at Hilton Head now, talking about the glory days of being a newspaper publisher. Those are the guys who led us here.
And there's no going back, right? Because I understand the difference you're making between the second-tier papers and the first-tier papers, but I guess I had sort of blindly hoped that the billionaires would be able to rescue us from a not totally free press, from not just simply propaganda, the internet ruling the world in a way where you will have no other truth options.
You know, I'm really tired of hoping that the billionaires are going to do the right thing. That is really not my structural model for a working republic, is hoping that the millionaires or the Republican voting Wall Streeters are either benign or civic minded. When anyone notices that, you know, Jeff Bezos is taking his hard-earned, I guess now it's $1 trillion, his net worth, and benignly investing in the Washington Post or giving this to charity, you know, there's a part of me that just says, how about we tax him at the rate of the Eisenhower era America? How about we just tax him at that rate for that, you know, for his income level, and we take the money and we actually we self-govern and we actually apply it to our society. And listen, you know, I'm a one percenter too. I say that absolutely with the awareness that I should be paying a higher rate of tax, and that nobody should have to rely on where I give my money. In, you know, obviously in much smaller doses than a Bezos or an Adelson or any of these big guys, but nonetheless, you know, this is what a society does. We all pay according to our freight and our share, and then we collectively decide what problems we're going to address with that money. We don't wait for the beneficence of the richest to ensure our society. This is insane.
I don't think he is yet a trillionaire, though he is trending in becoming that, because I think he's still
not. I thought
not,
he hit that mark.
I thought the reports were that he will hit that mark if he presently earns the, you know, if he keeps earning for 5 years the way he's been earning.
You may be right.
But regardless, your point stands.
I thought the stock run up on Amazon in the wake of coronavirus.
Maybe.
Maybe I missed it.
No, but you might be right. So from there, though, one man having that kind of power and paying $0 in taxes for Amazon last year makes you insane?
The whole thing is just the idea of that tax revenue has become some sign of poor governance, that you can literally have politicians promising not to raise taxes on anybody, on any terms, regardless of where the economy stands, regardless of what the needs of society are. They're not being heroic. They're starving what is fundamentally sound about a republic, about the collective entity that is society. And they're doing it in such a way that they're throwing nickels at working people and at middle-class people, and they're letting the affluent shove millions into their pockets. It's an astounding misapplication of our power to govern ourselves and to solve our problems.
What does David Simon say to the person out there who just doesn't understand why poor people are poor, why these desperate areas are this kind of desperate, why mass incarceration and redlining are issues that are systemic, that have enslaved and imprisoned black people in ways that are literal now? Like, what do you explain to the person who doesn't understand what the inner cities of Baltimore look and feel like, or what The Wire was meant to represent, and say, look, this is why what we've done to these people over many, many years is deeply, deeply, well, America's greatest sin?
Yeah. If they're white and they're thinking this way, it's really easy to put it in terms that are historical, whether they want to hear whether they want to hear it or not is an open question. But they've played you on this perfectly since Reconstruction. They've played you perfectly. You angry as you are, you know, white as you are, you have been left behind. You have been marginalized by the gamesmanship and by the frauds of this kind of end-stage capitalism. You've been made the sucker. And the only way they can get you to continue to vote against your own interests and serve their interests and further, you know, marginalize yourself and take away your own ability to dissent or reform your own government or to even believe in the idea of self-governance, the only reason they've been able to do this to you is that they've pointed to somebody black or brown or gay or Muslim, and they've said, you have more than him. Your status is more than him or her. You're going to be fine as long as you can step on them. And we're going to let you step on them. And we're not going to, that's who we're against. You're our buddy. And as long as they've had that person, and this goes back to emancipation, the idea that somewhere there might be somebody black or brown who has the same stake in America that you do or has the same viable future as you do or has the same rights as you do, that's more appalling to you than having your own future betrayed. And they've played that game on you beautifully, and they're still playing it to this day, and it's 150 years later.
It's interesting, David, because I've always thought of myself as someone who doesn't talk politics. I enjoy talking about race, and they're so intertwined at this point that I don't know if I can even intelligently make the argument anymore that when I'm talking race, I'm not talking politics or trying not to talk politics when you frame it that way.
Politics is race. You know, I mean, in our country, that's sadly true, which is there isn't anything you can look at. Why is the Baltimore City school system struggling when the county school system right over the line is viable? It's got a historic, you know, it's not because of black people. It's because where did the tax base go? Where did it leave from? And how did we allow that? How did we allow separate school systems to manifest themselves from the earliest points of integration? Like, you know, why is the policing different in white neighborhoods? You know, well, there's any number of reasons. Race is so tangled up. It's the great American pathology, and our inability to deal with it honestly affects almost every part of public life. I remember being in a meeting about, we were planning projects for the city staff for the Baltimore Sun. It was probably in the early 90s. And I remember the editor-in-chief came down to listen, sit down on the meeting. And myself and another reporter, it was actually Scott Shane, who later went on to the New York Times, we fell into the argument that we should do a project on race. We should, you know, race, it affected everything. It was the great overlay of what had gone wrong. Our inability to swallow the racial dynamic and to chew it up and make it into something, you know, modern and viable. You know, the fact that we were choking on the same fears that had motivated the country, you know, since Plessy versus Ferguson. If we just looked at the city of Baltimore and where race had transformed things and not for the better in terms of policy, we would have a great series. And I remember the editor-in-chief got up and walked out. That was the end of him at the meeting. He did not want to hear it. He did not want to hear it. It was, you know, he was very uncomfortable talking about race. He was very uncomfortable having it addressed directly. It needed to be, you know, it was like, why can't we just not talk about this and go on and just have it, you know, wither away as a problem? And, you know, there's a reason we don't talk about it. Talking about it's going to be really hard. It's problem solving in the reality of it is really hard. It's something the country has, you know, will avoid on any terms for as long as it possibly can. But the cost to us is profound.
David, I want to say I enjoyed this, but it was stimulating. It was also deeply depressing, and I don't feel like there's any light or sunshine anywhere for us to find.
Well, vote early and often, as we say in Baltimore. That's the only thing I can do right now is encourage everybody to vote for a better American spirit than is now being demonstrated by our leadership. You got to vote for the idea of hope.
Thank you for being on the show with us, David.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again. Appreciate it.
We're off from the radio show this week, but we will have some more South Beach sessions coming out here while we're on vacation. The next one will be about the career of Hank Azaria, a legitimate movie star. I saw him in Grosse Pointe Blank the other day. I'm always watching television, and there's Hank Azaria in Heat or some other movie. He just happens to be there. So we will talk to him about a pretty interesting career that includes The Birdcage next week. Also reminding you to check out the Lebatard and Friends Network. We ask you to rate, subscribe, and review. Support the stuff that we're doing around here so that we could keep it free for you all. The Lebatard and Friends Network. We need your help there. Subscribe, rate, and review if you haven't already. Or if you have, do it again. Next week, it'll be Hank Azaria.
Yeah, lots of good stuff on there, Dan. Marty Smith is on the NASCAR beat better than anybody. A nice little surge in his podcast rankings. I saw Jemele Hill join Sarah Spain's That's What She Said. Mina Kimes, you know what you're getting. Now a fully-fledged official NFL analyst for ESPN. Congratulations to Mina Kimes and the Mystery Crate. I know I have a very fun one with a person that wrote a book on one of the classic arcade games of our time, Dan, NBA Jam. And it's an entire book dedicated to this arcade game. So I'm very excited to put that one out there for our audience.
All right. A sneak advertisement for Mystery Crate making an appearance there. We'll talk to you next week with Hank Azaria.